Over the years, we bought a brand called Pop Sugar, and Brian Sugar, who was one of the founders of Pop Sugar, and I learned a lot from him because we have some similar styles and some different styles, but something that Brian was extraordinary at was hiring really great people and trusting them. And I was less good at the trusting. And if you're not very good at the trusting, it turns out you can't hire the best people because the best people want that trust and that autonomy. And as the years wore on at Group 9, I got better at realizing that truly there were better people for the job than me, whatever job that might be. And I learned that from Brian. And I would say that's a learning that I bring to everything today and that I've brought to Leader Hippo in how we've built the team here.
Welcome in to Studying Success. On this podcast, I interview entrepreneurs, investors, and CEOs who reveal their personal stories and advice for high school and college students on how to become successful in the business world. Today, we are joined by Ben Lehrer, who is a managing partner at Lehrer Hippo, an early-stage investment fund that targets New York-based businesses and that has invested in the seed rounds of companies like Casper, Venmo, and Warby Parker. Before Lehrer Hippo, Ben was a founder at Thrillist Media Group, which provides city guides to nightlife and restaurants in cities like New York and LA. Thrillist later acquired media businesses such as Now This and The Dodo to form the holding company Group 9 Media, where Ben was the CEO. Group 9 Media was acquired by Vox in 2022. In this episode, we discuss how Ben built Thrillist, what it was like to run Group 9 Media, and how Ben meets great entrepreneurs. Stick around to the end to hear Ben's stories about his close friend, Gary Vee. Here's the interview. Ben Lehrer, thank you so much for coming on Studying Success. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm so excited to talk to you. So please tell us who you are and what you do.
My name is Ben, and I am a managing partner of Lehrer Hippo. We're an early stage venture fund based in New York City. And in a not so distant past life, I was a founder of a company called Group 9 Media that owned a bunch of digital media brands in a holding company that we sold to Vox about a year ago.
So you founded Thrillist, and then you were the CEO of Group 9 Media, and now you're at Lehrer Hippo. How do you compare and contrast those different roles?
If you go back and look at how the things intersected, so I started Thrillist a year out of college as a kid, and I originally thought of it as a side hustle, and it got some momentum, and it eventually became my job. And then as I was building Thrillist, two things happened. One was I, through firsthand experience, realized that there was very little early stage venture money around in New York at that time. And that was one of the underlying reasons that I got excited about venture capital and thought there was an opportunity to build a fund like Lehrer Hippo. And also being a founder in a not yet developed or well-developed market, which was New York 12 years ago, astoundingly, if you got in a time machine and went back, there was actually like just a very small tech scene here and a very small community of founders that were building in this market. And so I was one of those sort of relatively few founders in the city and got to know the other folks who were building. And it was a really collaborative, collegial market, partially because it was such a small market. And through that is really the source of our original deal flow, which I was investing in people that I got to know who were building alongside me in similar categories or different categories. And so the fund sprang up from identifying the need in New York and knowing the folks who were raising. And so the two jobs were very naturally connected from day one. And then as we built both the fund and I built Thrillist and then Group 9 simultaneously, my insights and learnings from being a founder, I think, became instrumental in the kind of fund we built in terms of building a fund that I thought was value add and that treated folks the right way. And I knew firsthand what that looked like and felt like because I was a founder. I also was able to help companies in ways that I thought maybe some investors weren't as well suited to do because I myself was building and dealing with the trials and tribulations of trying to grow something with venture money, which obviously companies I was investing in were experiencing. And so the two things just had these really natural points of connection. Ultimately, I think I was a better operator because I had that investor perspective. And I think I was a better investor because I had that operator experience. I think it's a really magical thing when you get to do both at once.
Zeroing in on Thrillist, how did you come up with the idea? What were the origins of Thrillist?
I think a lot of founders, and I think in particularly very young founders, are often building to solve a problem that they themselves personally experience. For me, I was a recent college graduate coming back to New York City. city, trying to figure out, find my way around what to do socially and where to go. And I was always a very curious eater and nightlife interested person. And so Thrillist was a way for me to catalog the things that I was doing and really create a resource for people like me who I think had grown up reading sort of these generic city guides that we used to say that, like, I shouldn't read the same city guide that my mother reads. And so Thrillist was the product of my own and my business partner's curiosity as young guys living in New York.
You described the initial stages of Thrillist as a side hustle. What were those initial stages like, and why did you view it as a side hustle?
First and foremost, I viewed it as a side hustle because I had a job that was not that. And so right out of college, I worked for a hotelier named Andre Balaz, who owned the Standard and the Mercer and the Chateau Marmont and a bunch of cool hotels. And so I was working there, and my nights and weekends were me going out and exploring things and sending emails to people about what I was doing, which was the original Thrillist product. I think as I started building, or as we started building Thrillist, and realized that it was working and there was potentially a real business to be built, was when we started to get feedback from the establishments that we wrote about, basically telling us that we blew the doors off the place. And so a new restaurant would open, we would send out an email alerting our audience to it. And then I would call the place later that night and try to make a reservation, and they'd be like, sorry, we're booked for the next 2 weeks. And over time, we came to understand that we had built a following and we had influence and we could move the needle. And then I think once you have a captive audience in media, you start to say, okay, this is worth something. How do we monetize it? And at first, the monetization was really more about supporting the hobby and being like, wow, I'm going to get to go out and do lots of fun things, and I may actually make some money on the side. I think as we started learning more about the business model or the conceivable business models that we could go and tackle, we really got very inspired by what Daily Candy had built, which was a very similar business model and a really influential newsletter for young women. And we studied that business as closely as we possibly could. We actually raised our first money from the folks who had owned and backed and then owned Daily Candy. But again, I think it's important to remember that the idea of, I have a cool potential business idea, I'm going to go raise money, which now I think is something that is like widely understood to be conceivably possible. And there's like an ecosystem of investors looking to back interesting tech ideas. 12 years ago in New York, 13 years ago in New York, 14 years ago in New York, there was very little of that. And so I didn't say, oh, I got a business idea, I'm going to go raise money for it. We treated it as a hobby for a while because the idea that we could go raise capital wasn't something that occurred to me. And then once we started to get traction in the business, we went out and I think very naturally called the people that had invested in the company that we were inspired by, Daily Candy, and we raised money. By the way, we raised $250,000, which at the time felt like $7 billion. But in retrospect, and now looking at the market today, it was a very small amount of money because we had very little access to capital. We talked all the time about treating the money like it was our own, not treating the money like it was some gift or some like opportunity that some investor had afforded us, but we treated the money like it was our money. And we spent it, I think, very deliberately and methodically and very slowly and very carefully. And we built a business profitably. And we made money for the first several years, maybe not the first year of the business. Maybe we burned $20,000. And then we built a business profitably. And it wasn't until we went out and started raising larger venture rounds that we got comfortable, and probably too comfortable, with the idea of building a money losing business to underwrite, hopefully, exponential growth.
Can you just touch on a little bit why it's so important to treat investor money as your own and not use it willy nilly? Just make sure that it's used correctly.
So first of all, I think that is not the way that venture money has been treated for much of the last decade, and certainly not the last few years. That is not founders' fault. That's everybody's fault. That's VC's fault. Everyone around the table is in some way, shape, or form responsible for some of the mania and the hype that entered this space. And by the way, that's nature, right? Inevitably, things that are interesting and valuable and exciting get a little bit too hot. And I think that sort of the correction that's happening is probably a really healthy one. And I'm still, needless to say, an enormously big believer in the power of technology and where startups are going and the future of innovation and VC and all this. I think that we're in a hard period, but a period that is probably a very healthy one in the big picture. I think that the line around treating money like it's your own, I would actually say that we overdid it when we built. The thing that venture capital is supposed to underwrite is trying to do amazing things and taking risks and giving yourself the opportunity to take a shot. And I think you treat the money too much like it is the money that you're supposed to live off of, and that is like that it's your money. You may miss opportunities to take some important risk to try to build something really special. I think at the same time, treating money like it's toilet paper and like there's a never-ending supply of it and that money is cheap is really dangerous and leads to incredibly wasteful, silly behaviors. And I think the right thing is to recognize realize that every business is different. Every opportunity is different. Some areas require more risk and faster growth, and other ones should be built without needing to lose money. And I think that we got into a world probably broadly where the delineation between companies that should really raise venture capital to go out and try to change the world and anyone wanting to start any kind of a business got intermingled in weird ways.
So after you had the kind of MVP of just emailing people and for Thrillist, and you saw that it was blowing the doors off of places, what were the first steps to building an actual product? Was that the point at which you looked at Daily Candy and you were like, oh, wait, this is a great business model. We should incorporate stuff from their business model. Like, how did that process go?
So off the bat, we were sending emails to people. And by the way, today there is off-the-shelf technology to do everything and anything. You can go grab an email service provider and a Squarespace and a whatever and like be up and running in 7 minutes. Back then, everything was a slog and there was no APIs and you needed technical people to do everything. And so setting up something that today you could do with $10 in 10 minutes was like 2 months of two developers' time, which by the way, like created a little bit of a moat or a barrier to entry because you actually had to have technical people to do things that today you do not need anybody technical for. Once we saw we had influence, we started recognizing, okay, if we're going to turn this into a job, which we both aspired to do, what does that look like? What's a revenue model here? And we weren't inspired by Daily Candy. We 100% just copied Daily Candy. We were like, okay, this is exactly what they did. We're going to run the exact same playbook. We're going to sell the exact same ad units. We're going to call the same advertisers. We're going to do the whole thing. And look, for me, like it was deeply humbling, but also just a great experience where, you know, like our first advertiser was me hustling to a local establishment and convincing them that we could send them a lot of business and having them give us $500 or $1,000 and take some leap of faith with us. This is pre-Facebook. So local advertising looked very different. And then we'd go and do the creative and make the content and go through 100 rounds of revisions in the most inefficient, insane process that could ever exist. And then we would like traffic the ads and I trafficked our ads after I sold them myself and had to figure out what trafficking ads meant and signed up with, again, some totally antiquated, crazy, convoluted technical provider to help do that part of the system. And we just scrapped one day to the next. And I look back, I could never do it again. And I don't know what the hell I was thinking. It was a time in my life where just being creative and making my own way was just so exciting. I just felt like an adult. And all of the things that, you know, as I've gotten older, I think about in terms of, you know, prioritizing my relationships and my family and my kids and financial situation and whatever. Like, I just didn't have any of those concerns. I was just pumped to be making something and just hustled in the truest sense of the word. And I look back, I'm like, actually really, even saying this, I'm like proud of myself that I like went and did that because it was incredibly hard. But at the time, I was having a blast doing it.
After having that capital, was it like you grew exponentially and all of a sudden you're not blowing the doors off of just one place, but everywhere? Just walk me through that process of how you guys grew.
So we started off with a newsletter about New York, let's call it like twice a week. And maybe the twice a week went to 3 days a week. And then the 3 days a week went to 5 days a week. And then the playbook that Daily Candy had laid out that we cribbed was once you've gotten to some critical mass in New York and you have influence and you have like a relevant brand, you go to LA. And then you slog through building LA while you continue to build New York. And then after LA is at scale, you go to Chicago. And then after Chicago's, it's whatever that version of scale was. I don't remember. It was 5,000 subs, 10,000 subs. And then what ended up happening is you start to move into having a brand that becomes known nationally and national PR companies start to pitch you and everything that was pull starts to become push or push that was pull, whatever. And like things get a little bit easier. Information starts to come to you. You start to get recognized. And then once you add up the New York audience plus the LA audience plus the Chicago audience plus the San Francisco audience, you start to have enough national scale that you don't have to go only sell advertising to Bob's Bar in New York, but you can go sell to national brands. And we were also building at a time where digital media as a category was very exciting and on the rise. And there was like a broader conversation happening in the media around the decline of newspapers and the decline of television and the rise of the internet. And we benefited from that where big brands and big ad agencies were interested in meeting small digital brands that were going to grow because they needed to figure out how to buy digital advertising. And it was broadly the right time and right place, even though we were going through at the beginning in 2007, 2008, there was like a recession. Like we ran into some macro problems, but we were so little, we didn't even realize it. We were in this little sort of weird segment of the market where digital advertising was growing quickly and daily candy was explosively hot. And we were the answer to when advertisers got comfortable spending with daily candy, we could come in and follow up and be like, we're the smaller version for guys. And people knew how to buy daily candy. And so we made our offering look similar enough to theirs that daily candy did a lot of the market. They educated the market and we benefited from being able to pick up the mess that they had set up for us.
So you guys grew pretty quickly. What do you think are the keys to growing a content-based company like Thrillist? And what did you guys do to grow Thrillist?
We're talking about growing a media business before Facebook. So the way that we grew and the way that one would grow today have almost nothing to do with each other. And we were exclusively an email-based company. I would say one of the great benefits of the time that we grew at was we didn't even have the option to go and spend money to grow. We couldn't go and buy Facebook ads, which today is the drug that every company gets on, is going out and buying digital advertising to grow their audience. And it's a terrible habit and it ends up always coming back to bite you. And if you build your business off of arbitrage in the early days, you never really know if you've built the right product. The only way that we could grow was building a product that people loved and people shared. We had no means otherwise. We didn't have the money to buy advertising even if we could, for whatever that's worth. And we grew what I would call the very old-fashioned way, which is we made a product that people actually liked and we were patient. And so we grew quickly for that time. Now, with the way the world is connected and the size of digital audiences, we stayed small for a long time, but we grew the right way. And so we had a small but mighty audience.
It started out as your side hustle and then it grew into a business that was in LA and New York. And then you sold the company. What was it like to sell Thrillist? And then what was it like to join as CEO of Group 9?
So we took Thrillist and we were actually the buyer, not the seller. So I took Thrillist and we merged other brands into Thrillist to create Group 9. And so I was the buyer, not the seller. And the idea was, while building Thrillist, there was all these economies of scale that were hard. I wanted a bigger ad sales team, but I didn't have a big enough audience to justify more feet on the street. I wanted more infrastructure in technology, in advertising, but as a singular independent brand, it felt like there was a ceiling to how big that business was going to get. And so the idea of Group 9 was, let's go take some other brands and put them together and we can all leverage one ad sales team, one tech stack. We can defray the costs of those corporate services and we can spend more money on content, which is ultimately going to be the driving force behind this business. And so we did that. And I went from running one company that was, I don't know, let's call it 75 or 100 people, to a company that was 300 people overnight. And that was a really steep learning curve, culturally, really steep learning curve in every single way, and a really fun time and a really hard time. I would say we were lucky or smart or whatever that when we did create Group 9, we did so with a lot of capital. And so we raised a bunch of money into the creation of Group 9, which was both great because we were able to do so aggressively and ambitiously, but also really bad because the worst thing that a startup can have is too much money, because the one thing that always happens is they spend it.
I imagine it was difficult to go from 100 employees to 300 employees overnight. What were some of those challenges that you faced? And then what were the learnings that came out of those challenges?
Some of the challenges and learnings were related to learning what a holding company was. I think at first I had more of a sort of Lego fantasy of, once I've put people into corporate jobs, I've got a holding company. And the reality is that building the high functioning holding company where each brand gets to be the best version of itself was really hard, and finding the right leaders and getting the brands to buy into the strength of the corporate services required building really strong centralized services with amazing leadership. And I think I didn't appreciate how hard that was going to be and how important that was going to be in the early days. I think I also learned a lesson around the grass always being greener, which is, there was things about being a singular brand that I resented deeply around some of the things I mentioned before, around like cost basis and centralized services, et cetera, et cetera. Once you then got into a holding company, I missed some things about being a single brand where you can have this sort of all day maniacal focus on one brand and one audience versus having to be pulled in a bunch of different directions and a bunch of different fires that sort of came. Then challenges around how to think about success for the company versus success at the brand. And there was always these challenges with one brand feeling like they were getting the short end of the stick, or you were like sacrificing their success for another one, or you prioritize one group over another. And I think I just learned that like the grass isn't always greener and everything's hard. And look, the big learning that was not just related to that moment, but it's a learning that I continually have in my career is, and it's a very cliche one and everyone knows it, but like everyone knows it because it's true, is you got to surround yourself with people who are smarter than you. And particularly as you build a bigger thing, the quality of the executive team and the division leaders and even like the senior middle management, it became clearer and clearer that our success or failure was going to be based on me being able to hire and retain and inspire awesome, really talented people in leadership roles across the company. And over the years, we bought a brand called Pop Sugar, and Brian Sugar, who was one of the founders of Pop Sugar. And I learned a lot from him because we have some similar styles and some different styles, but something that Brian was extraordinary at was hiring really great people and trusting them. And I was less good at the trusting. And if you're not very good at the trusting, it turns out you can't hire the best people because the best people want that trust and that autonomy. And as the years wore on at Group 9, I got better at realizing that truly there were better people for the job than me, whatever job that might be. And I learned that from Brian. And I would say that's a learning that I bring to everything today and that I've brought to Lear Hippo and how we've built the team here.
I'd love to talk about Lear Hippo. So what kind of businesses do you invest in Lear Hippo?
So we are true generalists. And by that, I mean, we're investing across sector. We're investing in everything from consumer businesses to enterprise businesses, from hardware to software, everything technology in one way, shape, or form. And we're early stage investors. And so we're typically leading pre-seed or seed rounds, and we're investing all the way through Series B, but we're only leading pre-seed and seed rounds, and we're following on in A's and B's. And our brand, I think, is because we're investing early, we're really deeply focused on sort of founder and the founder market fit and the right person to build the right thing. But the quality of the team is absolutely paramount. And then secondarily, we are really focused on New York. And so the whole team is based here. We're about 20 people. We're all New York based. We have the largest community of New York based founders in our portfolio, over 200 companies that we've funded in New York over the last decade or so. And we're not exclusively New York focused at all in terms of our investing. We do about 60% of our deals in New York, but we really think we have some interesting unlock to everything and anything that New York has to offer. And for us, the sort of New York focus is a really important part of our brand and our go-to-market.
I had Cyrus Masumi on the pod this week, and he referenced your investment and mentorship in his company. How do you meet great entrepreneurs like Cyrus, and how do you know early on that they're great?
One of the real benefits of being extremely old like I am is that there's no substitute for experience and for being around. I'm not sure if you've read Malcolm Gladwell's book, Outliers, but the old 10,000 hour thing. Like, I've put in my 10,000 hours and then some in terms of building business relationships and connectivity with founders and just like the entrepreneur ecosystem in New York and the business ecosystem. And Cyrus is a great example. He was building ZocDoc physically in the same office building that I was building the real estate in Group 9. I met Cyrus probably in the elevator 10 or 12 years ago. Cyrus is good buddies with a guy named Mark Boyan, who is someone that I met out at a conference 7 or 8 years ago in Europe selling ads. And Mark and I became really close friends, and Cyrus and Mark were friends. And so that created like another sort of really warm point of contact where Cyrus and I realized that maybe we had not only office space in common, but friends in common. And so we became friendly and would catch up every 6 months, 9 months about what was happening in the world. And we'd lose touch sometimes and we'd stay connected other times. And when Cyrus had the idea for Dr. B, I don't know, 2 years ago during COVID, he and I were doing a catch up, just like one of our infrequent, but always interesting catch ups. I always had a huge amount of respect for Cyrus for what he built at ZocDoc. And just Cyrus is an obviously really big brain and also a really hard worker and someone who doesn't like to lose, all good qualities. He's also a very passionate, I'd say just like real leader and thought leader around sort of the changing landscape in healthcare. And so when Cyrus had an idea for Dr. B, which by the way, wasn't the idea that Dr. B is today, as is naturally the path for most startups, he was telling me about what he was working on. And I said, is there an opportunity for me to try to be in business with you? And he said, sure. And I said, hey, where do I send the money? And that was a few years ago. And it's been really fun working with Cyrus. And I think our relationship is obviously changes when you work together. And I would say in particular in this market backdrop where everything's hard and where you really get in like the foxhole with people. And it's been really fun working with Cyrus. But like, like that kind of serendipity of, oh, I happen to bump into him or I happen to get on the call with him. That's the product of being a consistent presence in a market for a long time. I would say for both of us, Cyrus is another sort of old school New York startup guy, old school meaning 10 years. And by the way, the best thing about being a VC is getting to generally spend time with really, really interesting, crazy, smart people all day long. Whether or not I'm meeting with a company that we end up investing in or not, even when we're passing on deals, we're meeting awesome people who are doing amazing things. And it's very rare that I have a day where I come home and I haven't gotten my mind in some way, shape, or form blown by the people who are way smarter than me, which is a really fortunate thing to get to do.
I was on the Lair Hippo website and I was just looking through all the companies that you all have invested in. And I saw VFriends was on there and I am a huge Gary V fan. I was just wondering, were you involved at all in that investment?
I certainly was involved in that investment. So Gary's one of my best friends and he's somebody who I love as a person, but also have an extraordinary amount of respect for as an entrepreneur. And I've known Gary for a really long time. And so I know when Gary's all in on something, and I know Gary's got his hands in far too many things, frankly, but I know when Gary's serious about something. And Gary's also really good at, he will literally pick up the phone and be like, okay, I need you to focus right now. This is real. I tell you 1,000 things and blather on about all kinds of insanity, but I'm serious right now. Get focused. And in my life, when Gary says that, I listen really closely and I've learned to listen really closely. And he called me with a not dissimilar call 6 or 7 years ago when he was co-founding Resy with Ben Leventhal. And he said, I'm serious. I'm all in. And I had the sort of fortune of also knowing Ben for a long time beforehand. And so that was not a hard decision to make. To back a Ben-Gary combo was an easy one, but we did that. And obviously they built a great company and had a great exit to Amex. And by the way, another very funny personal one, Gary called me in the heart of COVID and said, I know that you're going to think this is insane, but you got to buy something called a crypto pump. And I was like, they're $25,000. Are you insane? And he's like, I swear on my life. And I was like, oh, Gary, like, I hate you so much. This is the craziest thing I've ever heard. And I would say broadly, Gary was very right about that one. And I would say for everything that Gary's done, inclusive of Resy, the most significant call I got from Gary ever, other than some personal stuff, was him calling and saying, listen, I'm all in. I'm putting my reputation, I'm putting my entire heart and soul, and for the rest of my career, this is going to be the thing that sits at the center of where I put my energy. And I have a trust with Gary where I was able to say, let's go then, I'll do it with you. And I'm an insignificant investor in the context of what Gary has both raised and put into and built at VFriends. But if Gary's all in on something, I'm all in on that with him.
For a last question, how do you define success?
That's a really confusing one. And that's a multi-layered thing. And I frankly think a lot about that. I'm at that, hopefully not midlife crisis moment, but I'm at that moment where I'm like, what do I want this next chapter of my life to look like? And I think if you don't ultimately boil down success to how you feel and how you make other people feel, you're chasing your tail. Success is not like a business success. By the way, I've had like really good business success and crushing business failure. And in both situations, it doesn't last long. It can be really exciting. It can be really horrible. And the horrible thing, pretty shortly thereafter, you go, is that all there is? And the same exact thing for a great success. You go, that's it. Okay. That was exciting. But I'm still me. And like my family is still them. And like everything is still the way that it was. Maybe you have some nice articles written about you or like some more money or something, but there you are still. And so I think like success is, for me, success is like making my kids happier than I am.
Ben, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. This has been awesome.
I am so happy to be here. Thank you for having me. And this is so cool that you're doing this.
As always, thank you for listening. And please make sure you follow Studying Success to get notified when new podcasts come out. Also, please leave a review and send the podcast to your friends and family to show them what you learned. It would greatly help the show. I'm Will Burkhart, and you've been listening.